Chapter 6 A King's Ransom. Wool in Medieval England. Clothed in Lincoln Green. If I should die today, I'd dread it terribly. I don't know my Our Father perfectly as the priest says it, but I do know rhymes about Robin Hood. William Langland, Piers Plowman, 1367-86. Everything we know, or think we know about Robin Hood, is pieced together, quilt-like, from ballads, literary mentions, and other miscellaneous references reaching back as far as the 14th century. He is a contradictory figure. In one ballad he is a tattered gentleman, happy to give the proceeds of his righteous lawlessness away to the poor. In another, he keeps it all for himself. In one, he is a devout follower of the Virgin Mary. In another, enamoured of Maid Marian. Sometimes it is King Edward he meets in the greenwood. Others, it is King Richard. Two relative constants, however, are his hostility to corrupt monks and officials, and his costume of Lincoln Green. Today it is simply a colour, but the term meant far more to medieval audiences. Lincoln was a major centre of the wool trade, renowned for its wealth and the quality of its cloth. As Michael Drayton, an Elizabethan poet, put it in Polly Albion, his 15,000-line poem describing England and Wales, Lincoln anciently dyed the best green in England. In a time when the boundaries between classes were rigid, clothing defined who you were, what you did, and your social status. Despite living in the forest, Robin always seems to have a plentiful supply of the best fabrics on hand to supply new clothes to those in need, in exchange for favours and for disguises. In one of the earliest surviving ballads, A Jest of Robin Hood, written down in the late 15th century, Little John is referred to as a draper, and Robin as the richest merchant in Merry England. The comic climax of this work comes when Robin gets an unexpected royal visitor, Edward, our comely king, who begs Robin to sell him 33 yards of green cloth. When Robin obliges, the king and his retinue ride into Nottingham clothed in Lincoln green, terrifying the townspeople, who initially mistake them for the outlaws looking for revenge. Wool and the wool trade suffuse the landscape of the Robin Hood stories, just as they would have done the world of the storytellers and listeners. Steep prices for certain kinds of fabrics, backed up by sumptuary laws, ensured class, status, and even character could be divined by a glance at the quality and colour of someone's clothes. Rich and ostentatious churchmen, for example, might appear in fine scarlet cloth, a fabric beloved by the elite. A humbler and more sympathetic one might wear coarser russets, the cloth of cowherds and peasants. But clothing wasn't just down to personal preference. One law, passed in 1337 during the reign of Edward III, limited the import of luxury cloth and fur, possibly in a bid to stimulate the British cloth industry. Another, passed nearly 30 years later, was aimed specifically at ensuring social differentiation, castigating the outrageous and excessive apparel of diverse people against their estate and degree. The clothing of servants couldn't contain gold or silver embroidery. Gentlemen beneath the rank of knight couldn't buy cloth costing more than 4.5 marks, about £3. Craftsmen or yeomen could not wear silk, nor could their clothes be embroidered at all. These laws worked as well as the ones against silk in ancient Rome. Towards the end of the century, the chronicler Henry Knighton was still complaining that the lesser people were so puffed up in their dress and their belongings that one might scarcely distinguish a humble man from a great man. Whether or not they were effective, the resentments these laws stirred up can be heard roiling through tales of Robin Hood and even the rhyme at the heart of the 1381 Peasants' Revolt. When Adam delved and Eve span, who was then the gentleman? A staple diet. O wool, noble dame, thou art the goddess of merchants. O fair, O white, O delightful one. The love of thee stings and binds, so that the hearts of those who make merchandise of thee cannot escape. John Gower, Miroir de l'Homme, circa 1376 to 1379. In the 13th century, a poet from Artois in northern France used the expression carrying wool to England in the way that we might say carrying coal to Newcastle. Wool was the commodity that England was most famous for. It was relatively affordable, comfortable, and could be dyed a multitude of colours. Alone, it could be spun and woven into outer garments. Mixed with linen, it could be made into underthings and worn against the skin. Indeed, illuminated handbooks from the period specifically linked the wearing of fine woolen cloth to good health. England's flocks mottled her hillsides. The rooms of her poorer dwellings would have been furred with errant staples of wool in various stages of preparation, oiled, spun, woven. The walls of larger homes would have been clad in richly coloured tapestries, her ports clogged with soft, plump sacks of it, bound for Flanders, France, or Florence. The Normans, whose name reflects their Norse Viking roots, had conquered England in 1066. Like their forebears, a principal goal was the wealth created by its rich woolen industry. Unlike them, however, they were impressively organised. The Domesday Book, their countrywide survey of every settlement and how profitable it was, took 20 years to compile. The labour was worth it. The text provided a thorough picture of the economic landscape of their new possession and how much tax they could squeeze out of it. 1,000 years later, a number of the hulking castles they built to remind the local population who was in control still stand. The best land was divided between the Norman barons and the church, and they immediately set about reorganising the way wool was farmed. The largest landowners had flocks that numbered in the tens of thousands. The Bishop of Winchester, for example, had 29,000 sheep on his estates in the early 14th century. Henry Lacy, the Earl of Lincoln, owned 13,400. Although it has been argued that the primary purpose of sheep in the Middle Ages was their milk, used to make cheese, surviving price lists show how crucial their wool was to their value. Sheep that produced particularly fine fleeces would cost 10 pence each, enough to pay a skilled tradesman for a few days' work. A coarser specimen was worth only 6 pence. Merchants, who dealt with the wool once it had parted ways with the sheep, would have thought about wool in measurements of sacks and sarplers. Somewhat confusingly, the former is a medieval measurement of around 165 kilograms. The latter, a sack or more of wool repackaged for shipping. One consignment from this period that we know of consisted of 113 and a half sacks. At this time, a single fleece weighed between 1/2 and 1 whole kilogram. So this one shipment contained the wool of up to 37,455 sheep. Many places in England in the 12th and 13th centuries raised flocks and sold wool. Regions jostled with one another to brand theirs as the best quality. A price list from 1343 has the most expensive originating from the Welsh border. Another, drawn up a century later, indicates that Leinster had taken the accolade. This specialisation also carried on to the making of cloth. Lincoln was as famous for its reds as its greens. Lincoln scarlet was so sought after that the name was deployed similarly to the way a designer label is today. It was among the most expensive and desired fabrics in Venice in the mid-13th century. Two consistent areas during this period were the Cotswolds in the south, and in the north, the triangle between York, Lincoln, and Stamford. York, in fact, owed a good deal of its ongoing prosperity to its position as a collecting point for the wool produced in the surrounding area. Its merchants became wealthy by acting as the middlemen between farmers and those involved in trading the wool abroad from the port at Hull. Both cities suffered greatly when, in the 13th century, North Sea pirates began targeting ships stuffed with samplers of fluffy white gold, which encouraged traders to move their product laboriously by land down to London. Traditionally, most northern wool was coarse or hairy, but as wealthier landowners, including many Cistercian monks, became more prominent in the area from the 12th century, they brought with them more sought-after stock and better husbanding techniques, leading to finer wool. Nevertheless, quality continued to vary considerably. The best Yorkshire wool ranked 6th in the country on price lists from the 13th and 14th centuries, while the coarsest cost very little. Coppergate sits hunched on the bank of the River Ouse in York. Over the centuries, river water has trickled into the surrounding soil, keeping it peaty and moist, preserving artifacts that would normally perish in so unfavourable a climate. A dig on this site between 1976 and 1981 uncovered 6 centuries of textile production, stretching back as far as the 9th century. In all, Coppergate, an area 1,000 metres square and 9 deep, yielded 1,107 artifacts relating to textiles. Although small quantities of flax and even some strands of silk were unearthed, likely imported either ready-woven or as a yarn, wool reigned supreme. 25 raw staples, the defined locks into which a fleece naturally falls, were found, as well as 120 textiles and 58 yarns and cords from the Anglo-Scandinavian and medieval periods. There were also tools purpose-made for handling wool, and everywhere quantities of parasites endemic to fleeces. This unglamorous assortment has nevertheless allowed researchers to build up an intricate picture of what happened in the medieval wool trade. The majority of the wool, around 2/3, was white, providing evidence of careful selective breeding in the surrounding farms. This is a greater proportion than has been found elsewhere, and is interesting because white fleeces are easier to dye and therefore more valuable. Sure enough, Coppergate soil also yielded traces of a great number of dye plants. Weld, which produces yellow, woad, blue, and madder, a fine and relatively showy red. During this period, Britain was renowned for its incarnadine dyes. In an 11th century poem written by Winrick of Treves, circa 1068 to 97, the narrator, a sheep, praises the green cloth of Flanders, Rhineland's black dye, and Sauvia's tawny red, before turning to the most illustrious colour of all. Not blood, not sun, nor fire glows as red as you. Britain, glow ruby in my coat. Here, as in Viking lands, the first stage of processing fleeces would have been sorting them into grades. In this case, however, since a great deal of the wool would be traded and exported, this stage took on an extra financial dimension. Factors such as staple length and colour would be taken into account, as would provenance. The lowest of the low, called maulings, was the wool plucked from dead sheep. Breeds native to certain regions might have longer or shorter staple lengths, making them suited for different uses. The finest wool would be earmarked for luxury markets, Florentine clothmakers and traders, for example, while slightly lesser grades might end up in London or be bought up by richer local merchants. Stuff destined for local markets, or which merchants wanted to transfigure into cloth then and there, would be dealt with on site. First, the wool would be washed to remove the natural oils and lanolin that coat the fibres and inhibit their ability to absorb colorants. If being dyed, the wool would be dipped into the appropriate vats and then re-oiled by hand to soften it. One writer from 1683 recommended best rape oil, or for want thereof, either well-clarified goose grease or swine's grease. The wool would then be carded if it was a short staple variety, or combed if it was a longer stapled one. This drew out tangles and ensured the fibres in the floss were packed together less densely, making them easier to draw out when being spun into yarn. The tattered remnants of a wool comb, probably dating back to the 8th century, were unearthed at Coppergate. It had a double row of iron teeth set into a wooden base and, on the reverse, a hole into which a wooden handle would originally have been set, so that it would have looked like a particularly vicious broom. Also found were over 230 spindle whirls, the bead-shaped weights that were wedged onto the end of spindles and which help both with adding twist to fibres and in keeping them evenly spun so the finished thread isn't lumpy. Of these, 56 were made of bone, 36 of local stone. One 10th century example, incredibly, was found to have been carved from a piece of Roman-era ceramic. Once spun, cloth could be made from the thread. Again, many different considerations would have come into play when deciding what grade of wool to turn into what kind of cloth. Different weaves create different effects, making the cloth more or less warm or hard-wearing, for example, and therefore more or less suitable for certain garments. This required foresight and knowledge of likely buyers. There would be no point in a weaver using an ultra-fine ice-pale wool to produce coarse textured cloth unlikely to appeal to someone with a plump purse. Different cloths also used varying amounts and weights of thread. Coarser ones, such as russet, blanket, and burrell, would be made using scratchy wool and thicker, lumpier thread. Superfine variants suitable for, say, a courtier would need a great deal of very even, thin thread that, when finished, would have a smooth surface on which the weave would be almost invisible. A length of good broadcloth, for example, required between 2,000 and 3,000 warp threads, each around 30 yards long, and would take around 12 days to make. Warp-weighted looms, consisting of a high horizontal bar from which the warp threads are suspended using weights to keep them taut, were still common during this period. 33 clay loom weights were found at Coppergate, but newer and more efficient looms, such as treadle and two-beam designs, were becoming increasingly popular. Woven cloth, especially the finer kinds, would then be fulled. This serves a couple of functions. Firstly, it helps remove oils introduced during weaving that might hinder dyeing if cloth is to be dyed at this stage. It also fluffs up the individual fibres of a woven fabric and mats them together, making cloth thicker and less porous, and the meshes of the weave less visible. It had been done since Roman times by people physically trampling the cloth in tubs of urine or in rivers, but it was also one of the first steps to be mechanised. Mills powered by water began replacing feet from around the 12th century. Fulled cloth would then be stretched on a large frame-like device called a tenter, covered with hooks, which ensured the finished product was the correct size and shape. Finally, good cloth would be brushed by teasels to raise the nap and sheared to create a smooth finish. Although spinning and weaving was still done in private homes by women throughout this period, professionalised workshop production rapidly became more common. A guild called the York Weavers appears in the Pipe Roll, the official financial record of 1164. They were highly paid and later exported cloth directly to Italy and Spain. The Alberti of Florence, a rich and influential family, were in 1396 employing three of their ships full-time to ferry wool from England to Porto Pisano in Tuscany. Active workshops or mills could perform some or all of the processing of raw wool into finished cloth for a fee. There were even cases of tenants being contractually required by mill-owning landlords to use the latter's mill. At each and every stage of production, wool was a money spinner. White gold. I praise God and ever shall. It is the sheep hath paid for all. Motto engraved into the windows of a wool merchant's house, 15th century. In AD 796, Charlemagne, the first Holy Roman Emperor, wrote to King Offa of Mercia regarding a kind of large woolen cloak peculiar to the north of England. With regard to the length of cloaks, he wrote, you may order them to be as they used to come to us in old times. Offa's reply sadly hasn't survived, but Charlemagne's confident expectation of high quality reflects the reputation of English wool. The legendary king was far from the only one who admired the quality of England's wool, although he was unusual in his mention of a finished product rather than the raw one. In fact, for much of the Middle Ages, the places in Europe most famous for producing luxury cloth were not those known for the fineness of their wool. The Flemish and Florentine cloth industries, for example, relied on wool from Burgundy, Spain, and above all, England. The Florentine cloth industry was particularly voracious. Villani, a local chronicler, estimated that it employed around 30,000 people in the early 14th century. England had been shipping wool to Florence since at least the time of the Norman conquest, and by the 13th century was the city's most reliable source of fine wool. Bills of exchange, a relatively new financial instrument, encouraged such long-distance trading. By the early 14th century, Florentine merchants were using bills of exchange to import the finest English wool directly from Southampton, rather than through middlemen, giving this otherwise relatively insignificant island a notable economic role in Europe and guaranteeing a reliable source of revenue. The wool trade could make people rich. During the 13th century, the export trade grew to about 33,000 sacks, stuffed fat with the fleeces of around 7 million sheep, and accounting for about 60% of total production. One famous 13th century merchant, Nicholas of Ludlow, had claims in the trade amounting to £1,800 in 1274, a fortune. Wool also enriched the de la Poles of Hull, one of whom, William, later became the Lord Chancellor. Even royalty became involved. Edward IV, who retained a keen mercantile interest in the industry throughout his reign, paid 20 Italian craftsmen to instruct their English counterparts in the latest techniques of finishing and dyeing cloth. Later, he even used his own ships to export cloth and tin himself. It was also crucial financially for those lower down the social order. Smaller freeholders and tenants, unable to raise much coin, might pay some or all of their rents in wool. The wealth and influence that could be accrued through wool were instrumental in the formation of many powerful guilds, such as the drapers, mercers, and merchant tailors. Guilds shored up their reputation by policing and punishing petty misdemeanors by their members, such as shoddy craftsmanship and mismeasuring cloth, and were often granted monopolies, ensuring their members unfettered power in the marketplace. York's Guild of Wool Merchants, founded by royal license by Edward III in 1356, were exporting an average of 3,500 cloths each year, most commonly broadcloths, that were sold at the quarterly fairs at Antwerp. Guilds had a special, elevated position in society. At events involving pageantry, such as royal weddings, guild members wore particularly eye-catching clothing. When Edward I married Margaret of France, 600 guildsmen rode in a red and white livery. The Drapers Guild ordinances mention a violet ingrain cloth gown and crimson ingrain hood for their livery of 1483, while that of 1495 was parti-coloured murrey, dark reddish purple, and violet. These recall the Lincoln green livery that Robin Hood offered King Edward. This idea, while romantic enough in the jest, wasn't wholly fanciful. Kings did indeed become honorary members of guilds. King Richard II and his queen were admitted to the merchant tailors for the princely sum of 20 shillings each, and in return were either given or sold, the records are unclear, several yards of 8-shilling cloth and a piece of tartan worth 30. Kings, particularly those who flattered and helped the guilds, could in return hope to be generously bankrolled. Between 1462 and 1475, for example, the crown was loaned over £35,000, three times the sum Edward IV's predecessor Henry VI had received from the same source. And even this pales in comparison to the sum of £369,000 that three monopoly companies loaned the Crown between 1343 and 1351. The money tied up in the wool trade and its reliability as an investment, it could earn profits of 20%, greased financial wheels and provided the bedrock on which credit could be extended both within the kingdom and across borders. Clergy were involved in the wool trade as producers, but some, including in York, Dean Scarborough, Canon Robert Grar, and Canon Nicholas Ellicott, also invested in the trade for personal profit. When the Jews were expelled in 1290, many Italian bankers, whose business relations with England had been forged by the wool trade, stepped into the breach by providing credit. Florentine bankers, like the guilds, loaned large sums to the English crown, with wool tax revenue being used for collateral. Debts against ordinary merchants, if not royalty, were diligently pursued. When in 1280 five dealers from Banbury failed to pay back five sacks of wool that they owed to the Riccardi bankers, they were sued. Naturally, this trade, and the wealth being accrued by English subjects, didn't escape the notice of the crown, which, during a period of almost continual warfare, was thirsting for lucrative revenue streams. While Kings Richard I, Edward I, and Edward III occasionally directly appropriated or loaned the wool of their subjects when in need, most other monarchs contented themselves with taxing it. In fact, this was later at the heart of an early constitutional crisis. In 1297, the earls who made up the fledgling Parliament contended that wool, which they estimated amounted to half the value of the entire country, was being too highly taxed. "The whole community feels itself burdened by the tax on wools," they wrote, before repeating the point for emphasis, "which is excessively burdensome." They were right to be concerned. Royal meddling in the wool trade could and did have dismal consequences. From 1270 until 1275, Henry III, flexing his diplomatic muscles with all the subtlety of a preening Victorian strongman, banned the export of British wool to Flanders to demonstrate their economic dependence on England. In the 1290s, when Edward I invaded France, he increased taxes and sent a lot of coin abroad, making it difficult for his subjects to get credit. As a result, for three consecutive years, the quantity of wool exported from England was halved and fetched lower prices. When the crisis was resolved, the producers of wool and woolen products suffered far more than the merchants, because the export duties sharply divided their interests. The maltote, evil toll of 5 marks per sack of wool, was first levied in 1294. It depressed the prices paid to the producers while raising the price it was sold for. "And so it is those who own the wool," lamented the abbot of Meaux in the 14th century, "who pay this tax to the king, and not the merchants to appear to make the grant to him, for wools are sold at a lesser price the greater the tax payable to the king for them." Monk's habits. "O brother, beware those fools," he said. "Christ himself warned of such, and called them false prophets in the faith. They come in sheep's clothing, but inside they are wild werewolves who wish to rob the folk." Pierce the Ploughman's Creed, late 14th century. Two notable features of the Cistercian order, which was founded in France in 1098, pertain to wool. The first, which led to their being nicknamed the White Monks, was that they wore habits of pale, undyed cloth, distinguishing them from other dark-clad orders. The second was their preference for remote, lonely, even inhospitable sites for new abbeys. William of St. Thierry said that the site of Clairvaux, between dense forests and a narrow gorge of neighbouring hills, recalled the cave of St. Benedict, the founding father of the Benedictines. Rivaux, founded early in the 12th century in the northeast of England, was described by another writer as a place of horror and dreary solitude. Such remote locations were often ideal for rearing sheep. So integral did this activity become to the order, and so great their successes in the wool trade, that the Cistercians developed a rapacious appetite for land suitable for their flocks. One quick method of getting more land quickly was to buy up the estates of those who had become encumbered by debt, even if it meant becoming indebted themselves. The wool they would get from raising sheep on the extra land, they gambled, would soon help pay off the moneylenders. In the 14th century, Francesco Balducci Pegolotti, a Florentine merchant, drew up a list of wool-producing monasteries. 85% were Cistercian, and they were getting more for their wool than other producers. In part, this was an indication of their good husbandry. Better nourished sheep produce fuller, heavier fleeces, and processing. But it was also down to economies of scale. Their flocks were so large that they could send out wool in bulk and reduce costs. They also invested in their industry. Michael Brune, the 8th abbot of Meaux, built a new stone wool shed with a lead roof. The other buildings were made, according to the Chronicle of Melsa, of incorruptible oak. At Meaux, the monks' woolen habits were stitched at the abbey from cloth also made by the lay brothers. Of course, practices and standards varied from house to house, but the order seems to have shared knowledge and resources between its houses for their mutual benefit. Kingswood Abbey in Wiltshire was particularly successful, producing an annual surplus of 25 high-quality wool sacks. It bought rams from another Cistercian house in Lincolnshire in 1241 and gave gifts to the abbots of Diolacre in Staffordshire and Basingwork in Flint. Although the wool trade made the Cistercians of the 12th and 13th centuries wealthy, it also made them worldly. The more they trafficked in white gold, the further they strayed from their monastic ideal. Recognizing this, the Cistercian General Chapter continually attempted to control the order's participation in the trade. One oft-broken rule, which dates back to 1157, prohibited the monks from trading wool that they had bought for profit. In 1262, however, Lincolnshire traders presented a petition to the king accusing the Cistercians of illegal wool trading, which they alleged was resulting in the impoverishment of the king's city of Lincoln. Their petition shrewdly spelled out the effect this would have on the king's own purse. Customs were not charged on monastic wool deals as they were on secular ones. It worked. Or at least, the king sided with the traders. The Cistercians, however, seem to have carried on regardless. In 1314, another inquiry was launched into the English lay brothers' illegal trading for profit. The selling of a wool crop in advance, a kind of speculation, could also result in disgrace. In 1181, the General Chapter decreed that the wool of 1 year is allowed to be sold in advance in case of necessity. It shall not be done beyond a single year. There was an attempt to enforce this more strictly in 1277, but the General Chapter was forced to back down a year later. Wool could be sold in advance for more than 1 year in a row, provided that payment be made only for the wool of a single year. Robert de Skirena, the 10th abbot of Meaux, provided a cautionary tale. He borrowed heavily against the house's wool and, when he stepped down, his successors were saddled with debts of £3,678.03.11. A lion heart for sheep's wool. Look to yourself. The devil is loose. King Philip II of France, letter to Count John, brother of King Richard I. The story of Robin Hood is often entwined with that of the other English hero of the era, Richard the Lionheart. The denouement of the classic version is usually heralded by the return of the errant king from the Holy Land, just in time to prevent the execution of Maid Marian, to officiate at her wedding to Robin, and to save England from the usurious misrule of his younger brother John. Legends, of course, have a way of smoothing over inconvenient details. Richard I does seem to have been beloved by his people. He is often referred to as Good King Richard, but he wasn't really a very good king at all. For one thing, he spent most of his reign away fighting. When in England, a good deal of his energy was expended in finding ways of raising more money to fund all this warfare. In his birthplace and home province, Aquitaine, his nickname was the far less glamorous Richard Yes or No because of the terse way he spoke. Richard's three languages were Occitan, a regional dialect spoken in Aquitaine, Latin, used in official and foreign correspondence, and French. He would have needed a translator to understand his English subjects. Like so many European Christians, Richard was entranced by the glamour of the Third Crusade, an attempt to recapture the Holy Land. Troubadours and preachers stirred up enthusiasm, and those who took up the cross were offered indulgences, absolution for all wrongdoings, both past and to come, and a guaranteed entry to heaven. Those who didn't were given distaffs and wool, the implication being that if they wouldn't fight, then they might as well be women and take up spinning. Richard I was already famous for his recklessness in battle. The Third Crusade was imbued with the feeling that history was being made, and that Richard was determined to be the one gilded with the glory of the hour. Individual skirmishes, such as the Siege of Acre, were immediately turned into ballads. The three most prominent contemporary Muslim historians, Baha al-Din, Imad al-Din, and Ibn al-Athir, told tales of his bravery and daring too. Battles like the one outside the walls of Jaffa, where Richard, some 17 of his knights and around 300 foot soldiers faced down the far larger army of the Sultan, reverberated around Christendom. But the English king's arrogance maddened his allies, already furious at the attention and booty he was getting. And when an opportunity arose for them to take revenge, despite the threat of excommunication for attacking a fellow crusader, they were only too willing to seize it. According to a letter Henry VI, the German emperor, sent on the 28th of December 1192 to King Philip of France, Richard's difficulties started with a shipwreck near Venice. It meant that he had to travel by road through hostile territory controlled by his rivals with very few men. After twice evading capture, King Richard was finally apprehended in a disreputable house near Vienna by Henry's own cousin, Leopold, Duke of Austria. "He is now in our power," the emperor concluded. "We know that this news will bring you great happiness." Richard would be held hostage in Austria for a total of 1 year, 6 weeks, and 3 days. His long-negotiated release, when it came, was crushingly expensive. The price of his freedom, agreed at Würzburg on Valentine's Day 1193, was £100,000, to be paid in two instalments, as well as the loan of 50 galleys and 200 knights for 1 year. This was an astronomical sum, well over twice the total annual royal income. Paying it required extraordinary measures. In a letter to his wife Eleanor in April 1193, he exhorted her and his justiciars to do all they could. They themselves should give generously, he said, even suggesting that they borrow money to pay the ransom, so that you may give an example to our other subjects to do the like. They immediately levied a 25% tax on income and the value of movable property, demanded the silver and gold plate from the churches, and finally, seeking every possible means of raising sufficient funds, they turned on one of Richard's favourite religious orders, the Cistercians. Even the monks of the Cistercian order, wrote the chronicler William of Newburgh, who had hitherto been exempt from all royal exactions, were at this time more heavily burdened, for they were taxed and compelled to give up even the wool of their sheep, which is their chief means of support. When the news broke of his captivity, a great council of the realm sent two Cistercian envoys to Germany to track down the errant monarch. When they succeeded, Finding him at Ochsenfurt, a small, undistinguished town not far from Würzburg, they were received by the king affably and cheerfully, passing on to him vital news of his brother's perfidy and King Philip's designs on his continental lands. His need for funds was such, however, that it overruled any gratitude he might have felt. On his return to England, he took that year's yield also. "For when we were released by the emperor," he told the principal abbots who later came to visit him, "we returned in great poverty to our own country, and confiding in you in our most urgent necessity, we took from foreign merchants the value of your wool for our needful purposes." The Cistercians were livid. Thomas of Merton, a chronicler and an abbot of Moe Abbey in the West Riding of Yorkshire, alleges that even after his house had given 300 marks in money and value to wit, in wools, chalices, and other treasures, more was taken by violence and fraud, for they promised to return everything to us. Higden clips his words short in his 14th century history known as the Polychronicon. All the wool of white monks and of Channowns was a take. This was serious indeed. The Cistercians, more than any other religious order in England, relied upon wool. Making the loss more painful still, this wool had likely been sold in advance to foreign merchants in return for coin. The buyers would not have been sympathetic, and the failure to live up to the deal was likely to have saddled abbeys with debts it would have taken decades to repay. William of Newburgh was disgusted by the king's behaviour. "In this manner," he wrote, "despoiling those religious persons, under the appearance of flattery, reduced the most celebrated of their monasteries to an unusual state of poverty." Wool was the engine of England's finances. It encouraged speculation, profiteering, and the extension of lines of credit. It also played a part in a transfer of wealth, widening the gap between the richest and poorest, and accelerating the fall of the smaller landed gentry, all the while giving Britain a foothold in wider European affairs. Without the wealth generated by the buying and selling of wool, for example, it is unlikely that Richard the Lionheart would have been able to take so pivotal or expensive a role in the Third Crusade. And so it was only natural that wool became a means of paying the ransom for his return. The handling, production, and trading of this raw material were major occupations for many, from individual smallholders to guilds and workshops, like the one on the banks of the River Ouse. So ubiquitous was it that telltale wisps of white floss are caught on the barbs of otherwise disparate incidents. The clothing of a fictional outlaw, Italian bankers' interest in extending credit to the Cistercians, and finally, that monastic order's horror when 2 years' worth of wool was confiscated to ransom back a king. Later monarchs, mindful perhaps of the loans that both the guilds and the monks might extend them, and perhaps more afraid of going to hell, proved more respectful. In 1364, King Edward III introduced the woolsack, the large, wool-stuffed red seat reserved for the Lord Speaker in the House of Lords, an explicit reminder of the crucial role wool played in England's prosperity. It remains in pride of place to this day.